Transportation Committee will please come to order Thursday, May the 2nd, 1985. The time is 7:08. Members present, Representative Davis, Representative Penalberry, Representative Schultz, and Representative Cato. No members been excused. For the record, also note any late arrivals. Okay. You can tell I'm reading what's here. Today we have a presentation by DOT representatives from the University of Fairbanks Research Development Projects. Here I hope we're going to find out how they categorize and how they say what project's going to be done next, various things like that. We have with us Mim Dixon, the director, and Larry, are you?
I'm the research manager, Larry Sweet. I'm the research manager.
Larry Sweet, the research manager. So, yes, Mike.
I just want to say for the record, these are some of my favorite people from Fairbanks.
Oh. Well, you got an in, huh? That's how you get all your projects done. Now we know how he gets all his projects done, don't we?
They're well researched.
At any rate, ma'am, I'll let you take over.
Thank you. Good morning. I want to thank you especially for this invitation to present the DOT and PF research program to this committee. I'm director of the Division of Planning for the Northern Region of DOT and PF. And the Division of Planning has two parts. One is the regional planning activities, and the other is the statewide research activities. The statewide research activities, as you noted, are located at the University of Alaska, and we have a close working relationship with the university. And you already introduced Larry Sweet, who's the manager of the statewide research program. He's available to answer questions about specific research projects and some of the more technical things. In front of you is a packet that we assembled. It has the research notes, which is the monthly reports that we put out. And at the back of that packet is the research annual report. And in between those two is something that's a summary of implemented research that we prepared at the request of the legislature earlier in the session, and then a summary of that summary. And what I'm going to do today is give you an even more brief summary. And I know you're in a hurry today, so I will try and keep it succinct. My presentation is going to have three parts, and I hope this will address what you're interested in. First, I'm going to give a discussion of how research projects are selected. And second, I'm going to give an overview of the budget. And third, I'm going to give a summary of research accomplishments. So I'm happy to answer questions as we go along or at the end, whatever you prefer. And if we can't answer questions here today, we'll get the answers to you. I'd hoped we could teleconference this with Fairbanks so that the actual project managers and program managers for each of the programs could be available to answer questions, but we were unable to do that, so we'll get back to you with that. I prepared some overhead view graphs here that I'd like to talk from to give you an idea of what we do. This shows the process for selecting projects for the research program. Each year we solicit ideas broadly from the public, starting up here. We ask them to tell us what kind of research do you think needs to be done by DOT and PF. People submit a one-page problem statement to the research section. These come from the University of Alaska, other state and federal agencies, from within the department, and also from the private sector. They then go to the research section where our staff reviews them. At this stage, the staff looks for things like, has this idea been tried before? Is the concept technically sound? And they also, if we get several proposals of the same nature, we synthesize them so we're not duplicating what we're considering. Last year we had in the vicinity of 130 to 140 project ideas that were submitted at this stage. The research staff reduced that number down to about 80. Then we pulled together something called a research advisory board. In reality, there's two boards, one for the highway research program and one for the facilities program. These boards read that one-page summary. They listen to a five-minute presentation of each project, and then they rate the proposals on a scale of 1 to 10. And the cumulative scores then determine the priorities of each project. I should mention that these boards are drawn from within DOT and TF. They're from maintenance and operations. They're from design and construction. They're people that will actually be using the research when it's completed. They're looking for what's pragmatic, what's workable, what's needed. They're looking for the cost-benefit aspect of it.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Ma'am, the solicitation process.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, do you have an SOP promulgated in the department?
Yes.
That does this?
Yes, we have a research manual, basically, that's approved by FHWA that describes the process that we use.
But the department has its own, what they call them, policy and plan.
Policies and procedures, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we have one of those for how this is handled, is that right?
I'm not sure that we have it written up as a policy and procedure. It's more written up as a procedures manual. That is, the policy and procedures are usually one page, and what we have is a procedures manual that's quite lengthy.
Oh, okay.
I
think that's correct, and that came from Federal Highway Administration requirements. Since we get FHWA funds, there's an awful lot of this thing that is dictated to us. So our procedures manual is developed around the federal requirements, but we handle both our state and our federal program identically so that it's simpler for us. But we have a fairly thick procedures manual that details the Research Advisory Board and the process, the review process.
Okay, and how much public participation or non-DOT participation is in that advisory board?
There's none in the advisory board per se. The solicitation goes out broadly to everyone, so the ideas can come in from everyone. But the concept is that the advisory board represents the working parts of the organization who say, do we need this or don't we? Is this the most important thing? Can we use this or can't we? So actually, the ideas come from a very broad spectrum, but they're subject to that real pragmatic review by people who would be using them, essentially.
I was just going to say that I have never, in all the years I've been around, ever seen the private sector solicited, and I'm curious as to how you do that.
Yes. I've been the research manager for 5 years now, and that process had been in existence 1 year when I came. And at that time, only the DOT was solicited because the idea was, well, we're the people who know what the problems are. That first year that I was there and trying to get my act together, someone from the private sector came with an idea, and it was a good idea. It was rated very good, and I asked myself, well, why wasn't this done before? And the answer simply was we just hadn't arrived then. Well, what we started doing then was soliciting everybody who we knew of or who had contact with, universities, private sectors, DOT. And what has happened then over the years, the pendulum has swung to where in the beginning everything came from the DOT. Now more than half of our research ideas come from the private sector. And those from the private sector, in my estimation, tend to be the more innovative and the more novel. And
can we narrow the private sector down to what types of private sector? Contractors or?
Generally engineering firms and consulting firms, technical people who are involved in projects for the state, but we try to solicit as broadly any place we can find an interest.
Primarily we contract out a lot of the design work for the department, so those design firms basically are the ones that we get most of our ideas from. In other words, they've been working on a certain problem, say a design problem this year, and they say, if only we had this, or if we knew this, it would help us do our work better for the department. So it kind of comes full circle that way.
I might point out, though, that just because a person gives us an idea is no guarantee whatsoever that they are going to do the work. The process
is a process of
give us ideas of what you think we need or what our problems are, and what comes out of that is something entirely different.
Okay, after the research advisory boards meet and prioritize the projects, they winnow that down to a list where they say the top 15 projects in each program. That list then goes to the commissioner for his review. The commissioner looks at that primarily from the viewpoint of appropriateness. For example, last year, one of the high priority projects related to telecommunications, he looked at that and he said, why are we doing telecommunications research when the telecommunications function has been shifted to Department of Administration? And we said, well, we've done this historically, this is going to benefit the department. And he said, well, this year we will continue this one project, but let's write to DOA and tell them it's your turn to take over this responsibility. We did do that, and they then this year have put in a research budget themselves for the first time, and we've gotten out of the telecommunications research area. So that's the kind of thing that the commissioner is looking for at his review. Then we end up with a final program. It then goes to our research staff. The research staff takes those priorities, and if they do some preliminary research, like a review of the literature, or they start their investigation, there are some projects that really don't make any sense to do, and at that point, those projects get dropped off the list. In other words, just because they've been prioritized by the committee doesn't know everything there is to know, and if we find a good reason not to keep pursuing a project, we'll drop it.
Even after the commissioner says do it, huh?
Well, we go back to the commissioner and explain. We think this one ought to be dropped because it was tried in Finland and it failed there, and there's no reason to think it succeeded here or whatever.
And sometimes one year, the very number one priority, when we started the lab work, we found that well, the theory was great, in practice something else was going on, and it just wasn't working like we had hoped, so we dropped it in 2 or 3 weeks, just a preliminary investigation.
So in other words, we're not going to waste money if we don't think that, that there's a reason to do it. And there's that element of judgment that comes in after we get that list of our program. The ones that, after we do some preliminary work and we put together the proposals and so forth, to carry out the research, we have 3 basic options. One is to do the project in-house. Over the years, that option's been declining because of the level of work, and I'll explain that as we go along here. To contract it out to the private sector, or to do it with an RSA with other agencies, and that's primarily the University of Alaska. What this results in terms of where these projects go, FY83 and FY84, you can see the percentage of, now we're talking about capital expenditures here, and that's what funds the actual research projects. And you can see the percentage of capital expenditures each year. These 2 years are a little bit peculiar in a way. There's a very high percentage going to the private sector this year because we did the jet foil demonstration project, and that was a lot of money and it went into the private sector. This year, the jet foil demonstration project was completed, and the actual budget shrunk quite a bit. And so, for example, even though it looks like the university has a much bigger share of the budget, which they do, the actual amount the university has received over the years has been relatively constant. And in general, over the years, the private sector and the university get about 2/3 of the research capital budget. You notice the federal agencies here, and maybe you would have a question about what are we doing giving money to the federal government, but we do contract some with CORREL, the U.S. Army Cold Regions Laboratory, and the Department of Energy for the RL Lights program that we're doing. So in fact, we pool our resources with some federal agencies for a portion of the research that we do. Okay, what this has resulted in, at least last year, is a research program that looks something like this. We have 2 programs, the Highway Research Program, the Facilities Research Program. Highways program is funded from 2 sources. One is the Federal Highway Administration, HPR dollars, which stands for Highway Planning and Research, and it's designated by the federal government for research activities. The second source is state funds, in the general funds in the capital budget. The facilities research program is entirely funded with state general funds. In the handout
Are you going to talk to us about dollars?
Yes, I will. In the summary of research that you have in your packet here, this same information is presented on page 5 for the Highway Research Program. And then it gives a brief description of each of those subject areas, you know, what kinds of research are done in each of the subject areas. And you'll notice that roughly a third of the money is going to pavement, and that's because pavement's a very expensive aspect of road building, and we feel that that's an area where we can affect considerable savings to the states through improvement in our understanding of pavements. And then if you turn to page 22, is where the facilities research program description begins. Again, these are the same, I'm sorry, 15, is where the facilities research program begins. And again, there's a summary of each of the subject areas there. And I know you're in a hurry today, or at least we don't have unlimited time, so I won't go through those unless you have specific questions or maybe at the end. Then on page 22 is actually a list of the research projects which we were involved in the last year. And that gives the source of funds, the duration of the research, the expected completion date, the project manager within our department, and then who the consultant is if we've contracted out a portion of it. Before I go on, I did want to mention that I think sometimes people look at some of these items and might say, well, why are we doing this? For example, environmental research, why is DOT and PF doing that instead of DEC? This has to do with EPA requirements for auto emissions, and basically as we design highways, we are required to reduce those emissions. So we have to do modeling and research in order to know how best to predict that, particularly in cold weather. Energy systems is another one, of course, that relates to buildings. I just wanted to point out to you that rural power is a major problem. And in the rural areas, we've been building much more sophisticated systems. We've got computers out there now. We've got all kinds of sophisticated equipment, and we have a very rudimentary power supply, which is ruining that equipment and that investment. And one of the, in this packet of research notes that we've handed out to you here, there is one on rural power supply that just came out. I think it's probably right at the very end of your packet, rural power quality and state facility. And so, anyway, there are good rationale for each of the areas that we're doing research in that relate to public expenditures for highways, airports, ports and harbors, and buildings in rural areas. So it directly relates back to our program. Representative Knowlberry asked about the actual amounts of funding. This shows the funding history on the capital budget side. You'll notice that these dotted areas are the federal funds, the HPR funds that we're using, and the lined areas are the state funds. Now, the whole capital funding picture is in a real roller coaster here, and it's related very directly to the change in state revenue picture. In 84, however, you'll notice we didn't get any state funds, and we merely used carryover funds from the previous year to fund our program. I'd like to mention that this year the commissioner has withdrawn the capital budget, state expenditures for the capital budget for research, in kind of a similar move to use funds that are still available, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit more as we go through here. But basically there's three reasons that the commissioner is doing this. One is the research advisory board process, which I described to you. He believes that that's out of sync with the whole budgeting process. In the past, what we've done is had those research advisory boards meet in April. Then when the budget is funded in June or July or whenever it's funded, then we go down that the priority list and fund those projects. What the commissioner would like to do is have the group meet in June or July, plug it into the budgeting process so that when we come to you with our budget for next year, we'll already have the research projects identified. And so he's trying to be more responsive to the legislature. And for that reason, the Research Advisory Board did not meet in April. It'll meet later. And in order to make that transition, we've withdrawn the state funds from the capital budget for this year. And we'll be using the funds that are already available to research. So basically, this is probably a good time to make that transition, as I will explain to you as we go through the operating budget.
Yeah. Does that mean in fiscal year 85 we had just less than $1 million in state funds?
800,000.
Yeah, it was about equal state and federal funds for the capital budget.
And that's for how large of the capital budget?
For, I mean the total for the department? I think that represents about how much of the department's budget? 1%?
That? No. a guideline that I have been trying to suggest is that some policy for a level of research be made, and I suggested 0.5% of the department budget, which is far less than what even low technology industry in the United States is funded. I think we got something like about, we had 0.2% last year. 0.2% of the department budget went to research in the capital.
The capital budget. Okay. Now I want to talk a little bit about the operating budget, and then I want to talk about how these two fit together, because that's really the problem that we need to be looking at today. I got copies of the Blue Book part of this budget. I didn't know if you had
the short
form. Yeah, this is just the short summary form. I don't know if you need to have a look at this to go through here. Now, what I've done is pencil in my own figures that I understand are the right figures. If you'll notice on page 2 of this, where it says the House and Senate numbers, well, these were the numbers that I think are the best numbers that I've gotten. If they're wrong, I apologize, because I know that those budgets are just being printed now. But essentially, you'll notice that in FY84, our actual for operating budget for statewide research was $1,043,000. The governor's budget request was $1.2 million. This would have been a steady state budget that would have accounted for inflation and salary raises, but no new positions, and basically this is a hold-the-line budget that the governor proposed. Since that time, what's happened, if you look down in funding summary, we've substituted $350,000 in federal funds for state funds. This would come out of the HPR dollars that would otherwise be used in the capital budget to fund projects.
Which HPR mean?
A highway planning and research. It's FHWA money. We can use that legitimately. The federal government lets us use that to help fund salaries, but only for people who are working on highways research. So basically what we would do is be subsidizing the highway side of the research with federal funds. And then we reduced the state funds in the House budget to $267,000, which is about a 75% cut in state funds for research. And in the Senate version has slightly more funds in there. So the total in the House right now is $617,000, and the total in the Senate right now is $801,000. With the House version, which is what I'm going to speak to today, primarily because this is a House committee, and I'm happy to address the Senate version if you have questions later, but this would have a net result of cutting 8 positions from the program.
I'd like to how many?
Well, let me talk about that. I'm going to show you right now. It depends on how you look at it, but let me just kind of show you what's happened historically here. This is the position count authorized and filled positions. And you'll notice that right now we have 18 authorized and only 15 filled positions because of the budget. So we'd be roughly cutting more than half the program, half the positions with the current House budget. Let me show you what that means over the years. This is what the research staff looked like in 1983. We're talking about May 1st in each of these cases. The gold color here is the actual research managers. These are the project engineers, the people that are managing the projects. The blue people are the support staff. This includes laboratory assistants, the field assistants, the clerical staff, and the administration. Okay, in 2 years later, 1985, as we stand today, the ones that are hatched here are the ones that have been eliminated in the last 2 years. And what's left, now the people that are in those positions have changed and the organization has changed around a little bit, but those are the positions that remain today. With the, and that is a 37.5% reduction over 2 years in staff for the research section. With the budget that has been passed by the House, all the positions that are hatched would be eliminated or vacant, and only 8 positions would be remaining. You can see it's a balance between support and project engineers. But roughly, That is a 66% cut over 3 years ago.
Well, it seems to me that you need a champion in the legislature, and not to put the burden anywhere else, but the vice chairman of the finance committee, from Fairbanks, for goodness sakes, has this been brought to anybody's attention on finance?
I guess I'd have to ask the commissioner's office that question. Basically, the directors don't deal with the legislature directly except when we're asked questions to provide information. And so it would be inappropriate for me to approach someone in the legislature on this subject, which is why I welcome the opportunity today to present this information to you.
I'm glad we asked.
Yeah.
We have a brown bag luncheon every Thursday. I don't know if you know about that, but the Interior Delegation does, excuse me. So I'd like for you to talk to Steve Frank and see if you don't have lunch plans to come join us, and maybe you could talk a little bit about this. I knew that there was cuts, but I didn't realize it was going to be that dramatic, and no one told me that. So
that's a shocker.
It is.
I'd be delighted to do that.
A number of people from the science and engineering community, private sector in Fairbanks and Anchorage University have written a number of letters of concern. The university is concerned because our program has funded 85% of the School of Engineering's research, and I think some faculty members have written and said that their classes use information about our projects. We hire their students. It's been a very close working relationship that's built up over a course of years.
Incidentally, I might mention that what would happen with the House's present budget with research is that because we have the HPR monies to subsidize highway research, we would essentially be eliminating our entire facilities research program. And keeping a small highways research program is basically the strategy that would go forward. Let me talk about the effect a little bit further, if I can, of reducing staff. This shows the number of projects, and most projects take 2 to 3 years to from the time they're funded or started until the time they're completed. So we have kind of a cumulative effect because you're starting new projects all the time and then you're closing them down all the time. But the capital budget has fluctuated, but the net result has been a growth in total projects over the years in both highways and facilities. And you'll notice that administration has stayed relatively constant. That administration, incidentally, has to do with new products testing projects, experimental features, a certain program element that goes along there. So at the same time, we've had fewer project managers, and so the workload per project manager has increased significantly. You can see that back in '82, project managers were handling 5 to 8 projects. I feel that's a reasonable, responsible level of activity. Over the years, with the budget cuts and the cut in personnel, that number has risen. So today we have project managers on the average handling 13, 14 projects. That I think is too many to be doing a good job and doing it responsibly. If the House budget goes through as it's been passed out of the House, this is going to put us up to 23 projects per manager. That's unworkable. What we would have to do is either close down some projects or treat them as grants rather than contracts. In either case, the state would not get any payoff from its investment, because we found that those projects really have to be managed or you won't get them to completion, you won't get a final report, you won't get something back for your money. So we will be faced with a choice of either stopping what's already been started and pulling back the money or treating it as a grant.
Ma'am, on that alternative of treating them as grants instead of contracts, it seems to me that if you put a grant out there and you have a certain reporting requirement, you say you've got to come back to us in a year and you've got to give us a scholarly piece of work that has the following outline or whatever, that people are either going to do it or they're going to be your grantees will either do it or they will be ineligible for future participation. I'm sure they wouldn't want that to happen. So it seems like a reasonable alternative to let them just go out there and rely on the private sector to bring back something with quality.
That's certainly an option. I think we lose a few things. For one thing, since I've started as director of this division, one of the things that I've insisted upon in every final report is an implementation section that talks about how do we take these results and implement them back into the department. In other words, what is the recommendation for how to use this research that's been funded? I think in order to do that, you've got to have some interface with the department. And along the way in doing the research, there's opportunities to make certain decisions. Do you go this direction or that direction? It's not a contract like you have for a construction contract where everything is completely spelled out at the beginning, because it evolves a little as it goes along. And I think what you'll find, particularly in dealing with the university, that left unmanaged, people will gravitate towards a more theoretical approach to what they're doing. And when we manage them, we try and manage them towards a more pragmatic approach and the more useful and practical approach. And so I think that there's a great payoff to the state from the investment in managing these projects rather than just running a grants program.
If you don't work on a day-to-day fashion with the people, you don't get a product that you end up wanting. We don't do basic research. We do applied research, everyday problems, simple pragmatic things. And it takes a working relationship on a day-to-day basis.
For the amount, we're talking about a $1.2 million operating budget to manage the capital budget, what I consider responsibly and productively and effectively. And I think that basically what you get out of that pays off. And that's what I want to talk about next, if you want to move on. Is that okay? What I want to do now is talk a little bit about the accomplishments of the research program. And I look at the accomplishments as six types of accomplishments here. You could divide up this pie any way you want. But actual dollar savings to the state, improved safety and preservation of human life, improved commerce, developing standards for state buildings and road construction. In other words, research does the work for standards and technical services to some great extent and works with them on developing standards. Technical assistance services within the department and to other agencies. And then we have a component which we provide a service of helping to train engineers for the future.
If I can just hold you up, the last three seem to be, I wouldn't really call them accomplishments. The setting of standards for state buildings and road construction probably fall into one of those categories up above in the first three.
I think we could.
We're talking about how your accomplishments are used, I guess, but
yeah.
I see three categories that are of interest to me.
Okay.
That's at the top.
Okay, well, I kind of added on, especially number six, because I couldn't figure out where else to make the statement that Larry just made for us on our role with the university and how I think that's important. So, you know, maybe I shouldn't have called them accomplishments, but I did the first four, and then I thought, well,
benefits.
Maybe we should mention that these are benefits to the state. So I would agree with you about that. Let me go through each of those briefly, and I picked out examples which I thought were good examples. They're not by any means exhaustive, and they just are kind of representative. It's been said that in any given year, the research program does something which pays for the whole research program, and these are some kinds of examples. If you lift the load limits too soon during the springtime, you can do damage at the rate of about $200,000 a day. And we've developed how to use something called the falling weight deflectometer. You're going to hear some more about that as we go along.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah, this isn't just last year. I mean, this is kind of a summary of some major accomplishments, although we're still using it and perfecting how to use it.
Last year, for the first time with that instrument, though, we were able to determine some roads that didn't need any load restrictions at all. We put them on in the past because we had a blanket policy, but now we've become sophisticated enough with that tool to recognize that some don't need any load restrictions at all.
And I'm going to mention that again, too. Another point I want to make with the falling weight deflectometer
since we're starting there, is that this is an instrument that was developed in Scandinavia. We didn't develop it in our research lab. What we did is we brought it over here, we tested it, we figured out how to use it for our particular circumstances, we transferred that information to the department. This is a very cost-effective way to do research because what we're doing is taking what somebody else has already developed and adapting it with very little additional investment from us. We figure that we save at least $50,000 a year from design procedures that were developed, which basically reduce the need for soils testing in the design of roads. We save $100,000 a month.
I don't understand what we're doing.
Okay, well basically we looked at how to design roads, developed new design procedures, whereby in some cases you don't have to take as many soil samples under certain circumstances as you would previously when you didn't know what you were doing, so you took a lot more soil samples. So by not taking those soil samples, you're saving a cost that goes into the design of a road. And we figure that total savings to the department is something in the vicinity of $50,000 a year by not unnecessarily taking soil samples.
There was a procedure that was eliminated called R-value testing. It was a standard procedure. We found that that wasn't doing anybody.
Incidentally, as I go through these, there's a little bit more detail on each of these in the handouts that, you know, if you go back later, you know, what did she say about this? Or give us a call and we'll get you in touch with people that actually worked on them. When a chip seal fails, it costs $100,000 a mile to go back in and replace. And we had a research project that cost us $50,000 that basically identified the major causes of chip seal failures and developed ways to prevent those failures. Now that's been happening for a couple of years. We haven't had a chance to go back and see to what extent we actually have saved money, but sometimes chip seals fail the very next year.
What's the difference between chip seal and what the Canadians do as far as the high-float emulsion?
There's basically three types of pavement. There's a hot mix, which is the most expensive. Then there's a chip seal, which is a procedure that became very popular because it was cheaper. And we started that in this state, and we ended up with a very high failure rate. That's what initiated this research project. We went back in and found out why we had a higher failure rate than the other states. The high-float emulsion is yet a less expensive first cost or at first look procedure that we were aware of when the Canadians started because we worked with them. We've watched that, we've sampled that, we've put down three test sections of our own on the high-float emulsion, and we continue to have concern. We don't see that that is cost effective. It's a simpler process that may not have a long-term life cycle cost benefits.
What is the difference though? What is high float emulsion compared to chip seal?
There's a difference in the procedure of the asphalt oil that's used, and I don't know the technical details.
Well, I was wondering, the thing here, you had that it costs $100,000 a mile. Is that what it costs? It costs more than that to chip seal.
To go back and repair a chip seal. Basically, what we found in our chip seals, when we look at 120 sections, the failures were all when the temperature was cool or when it was damp. And Alaska tends to be cooler or damper than other states when you're putting this down. Because of our funding cycles, we end up doing it in the late summer and early fall. We have completely stopped that because we realize we're throwing money away if we do chip seals when the temperature isn't very warm and very dry.
But how much does it cost a mile to do chip seal?
I don't know. It's more than $100,000 to come back and
repair. Or they're just wondering because now the Canadians, the Yukon Territories, when they put the high float emulsion on the Alaskan Highway, up, and this is including last year, it was costing them $20,000 a mile to put the high float emulsion down. The highway, the Alaskan highway that you drive is made out of that. And that's at the cost of $20,000 a mile. So if it's costing us $200,000 a mile for chip seal, we should be looking at what the Canadians are doing.
We are, sir, and we've laid down three test sections in Alaska. Three regions, and we're looking at it closely. But our efforts so far don't indicate to us that that's cost-effective in the long run.
A couple of problems with chip seal that we become aware of as a result of this testing. One is that, it's high-flow emulsion. One is that in Canada, they do it by the highway department, and they've got the right equipment, and they've got the system down, and there's a certain sequence in which you have to do things, the system, the timing right. Here, we've done it with private contractors. They don't have necessarily the right equipment and the experience, and it hasn't worked as well as it has in Canada. And second, in Canada, they found that high float is lasting about a year, maybe 2 years at the most. So it's more a dust control approach than a paving approach. It is less expensive on a first cost basis. We're not convinced yet in the long term that that's going to be the most cost effective.
But even with the cost per mile that the Canadians are spending on it, and they've, in talking with them about it, they have said that yes, the road doesn't last. It's almost like grading a road or something else. But they have the system down to the point that they'll have stretches of road 30, 40 miles long that will never develop a pothole or anything else. I mean, it's just as good as the day it was put in for year after year after year. Some of that stuff's been there, 7, 8 years up there on that stuff. Where they do have go through bad permafrost areas, they have it down to a science. I mean, they just send a crew out there with shovels and things, and they just fill the potholes up and move on down the road.
Well, one thing about the high-flow emulsion, Canada uses a different grade of asphalt than what we use. The asphalt they use is not available to us, evidently, through our asphalt sources. And I think that has a lot to do with it. I would like to see us find that available and get into the high float. I've said it for several years now. And recognize that
this is a real important research project. Yeah. And
for some areas of the state, there's absolutely no reason to go in at the $1.5 million or $1.2 million or whatever it is, dollars a mile, and put the 2 inches of asphalt and then come back in a couple of years and put 2 more inches. There's absolutely no reason. Give an example, that Northway stretch. That Northway stretch will be, we've spent $20 million or $50 million or whatever it is on that stretch of road. In a short period of time, that road's going to go to pieces.
Okay?
Because it's permafrost, and that road just continually settles right out from underneath its, road. It doesn't have a base. What you need to do in stretches like that, you don't even need to, you can just build the road base up. Simply go on down to where you've got a salt and start paving from there. Skip that thing and put the high-float emulsion down.
Yes, sir. The research section has done research on those very areas, and we have recommended more than once that be a high-speed gravel road,
right.
Because we don't feel it's cost-effective.
Right.
There's other areas of the state that you can have a good high-speed gravel road. There's a public education problem there, too, because the public perceives that you're going backwards if you had pavement and now you have something else. But I couldn't agree with you more, and we've done a lot of work on that and economics on that.
Yeah.
And,
because we're just throwing money into those projects, and like I said, we put millions and millions of dollars into that project, and it's not going to last.
This is another example like that, where Anchorage was set to pave a runway that would cost $3 million. We took that falling weight deflectometer there and in one day determined the paving wasn't going to solve the cracking problem. And so we saved the state basically $3 million from not paving it and then having to turn around next year and tear the whole thing up and do the right thing. May I go on, or did you want to? Just some other examples, we developed solar-powered flasher signals for highway and rail crossings that are expected to save the state $406,000 over the next 21 years. I realize that's a long span of time, unless that is a long-term cost saving.
I understand that you're requiring one to be put in down around the Nenana area, and I'm just wondering where you have pretty consistent temperatures of 50 and 60 below zero. And these solar-powered flashers on the railroad crossings and things. Have you put them out in a remote area like that?
Yes, sir. There's the first one, I think, was on down past Nenana, and the battery box is buried in the ground. ground, and the snow cover keeps it plenty warm. We haven't had any trouble. It's worked very, very well. We're very happy with it. And even in the dead of winter, there's enough solar energy to keep it going. The trains run less frequently in the dead of winter, too, so it has less draw. That's an example of a simple. There's no electricity out there. There's no power out there.
So, that would be a considerable cost.
Yeah, so it's much more than $406,000. I mean, you consider that you have to send one of your electric technicians out there to fix it every 6 months or something.
I think all these figures are very conservative. We didn't try and overstate the case here. In fact, we looked at these figures yesterday, and you're going to carry some of them back a little bit more. So I think you're seeing some, these things aren't things you go out and weigh and measure exactly. They're estimates, basically. So, and you're conservative estimate. A single lawsuit against the state saved the state $3 million, and the main defense was research. Basically, it had to do with research on sanding that showed that the state was not being negligent because we were trying to solve this problem. The Attorney General's office increasingly now is looking to research as a defense, and we're being called upon to testify, basically to show that the state is not ignoring these certain types of safety problems, that we're working towards certain goals, and that seems to be an effective defense. So that's just another cost. A way to look at research in the state. Another way that research has saved in lawsuits, another suit, it was $200,000. The information in a report that had been put together by the research program was used as part of the defense, and that lawsuit was also won. This also is a very conservative figure. We figure that you save at least $300,000 per river crossing if you can use culverts instead of bridges. However, in order to use the culverts instead of bridges, we've got to get Fish and Game and DEC and other people to sign off on that approach. And they're not convinced that that's the best thing for fish.
How
that
big are culverts do they make?
They make big ones.
Train down a sewer, for example? I mean, that's the case of basically culverts. The last few years, where they've had the avalanche problems, what they've done is put in this, it's a giant culvert for trains to go through, so if the avalanche comes, it's going right over.
We're looking at different ways to put in culverts. We're looking at a lot of hydrology, fish passage research, trying to get the data together to convince the other departments of state government that this is a good way to proceed.
I would appreciate it if you'd take a look at two bridges on a road.
I bet it's in Northway.
That's right. In Northway. And the feasibility of putting culverts in there instead of bridges, because there's two bridges. There are two one-lane bridges going into Northway over Fish Creek. And anyway,
good point.
The
I'll
present cost of that thing, and we can't come up with the dollars, is about over $2 million.
It's a good example
of
where...
Can you compare that then to our annual operating budget to see if we can develop the criteria, and we have from our work on fish passage through drainage structures to date, we have developed enough information that we have some interim procedures that are being used by the department and are acceptable to Fish and Game for the design of culverts. They have already more than paid for all our research to date on
that. So I will look specifically into that and get back with you on the information.
Appreciate
I'm familiar
it.
With that problem. Okay, I didn't list out all the other examples, but I just wanted to mention to you, for example, we're building a runway in Shishmaref. Standard design would have us barging in gravel for the runway because there's no gravel there. It's just a little sandy island, for those of you who've been to Shishmaref. The research section identified the possibility of using something called a sand confinement grid, which has been developed elsewhere, a plastic grid system. We went and looked at those and tested them and evaluated them, and now that airport's being built using the sand confinement grid, which looks like a very structurally sound way to go, which is going to be considerably less costly than had we had to barge in gravel there. Another example is we've been working on roadway insulation, which can save several inches of gravel from the roadway design. And so that's another cost-effective project.
I have one thing that I've had a lot of old-timers tell me on the building of roads, and they've been involved in construction for many, many years up here through permafrost areas, and you always have the buckling and the heaving and things in the permafrost area. Now, I've had some people tell me that if you would come into an area, and let's just say it's 100 yards long, if you would come into this area, strip it down to the permafrost, and it just turns to muck, of course. Take piling, drive the piling, just drive it down until you hit a solid base. Okay, drive it right on through until you hit, you know, drill it, whatever you have to do to find out there's bedrock down there. Drive piling down, then come in and put a layer of cement and that kind of stuff, blocks over the, for, cap this stuff off. Then the mesh stuff that you're putting down on the roads now, that
textiles,
right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Put those mats over the top of that. Then come in with your bull rock and whatever over the top of that. That would build a base, and that it would never settle.
I think that could be done, and that's
very
essentially
expensive.
Building a bridge.
Pardon?
It's essentially building a bridge. There may be a cheaper way, and we've put in two installations you've got in your packet there. This is using these thermopiles like they used on the pipeline. In Fairbanks, we have an installation, and the Bethel bump, the infamous Bethel bump on the Bethel Airport was solved that way. So that keeps the ground frozen and stabilized, and that looks like it may be cheaper.
There's an infamous Northway bump, too, on the road going into North. Honest to God, there is. It's over the period of years, I think they've drilled that now, and it's 70-some foot or 80-some foot of gravel that they have put into this one place. Just as soon as you cross a one-lane bridge, there's a little thing you hit. They'll fill it up, level it off, and it'll be great. You'll drive over it, and then, you know, about the spring of the year, there'll be a little dip there, and then it'll get worse. And then, you know, pretty soon you're airborne, and then they'll come in.
Those are the kinds of problems that research is looking for, more cost-effective solutions than just dumping gravel or pavement into a big sinkhole.
Did you ever fix that sinkhole by the entrance to the university?
That's the one that is in your packet there that I just showed up.
Okay, I know that your time is short. I don't want to rush you, so interrupt me if I'm going too fast through here, but I do know that you do. In addition to cost savings, I mentioned improved safety and preservation of human life. Some examples are developing a halon gas system for bushfire protection. This would be used instead of a sprinkler system. It's cost effective as well as safety improvement. Developing rubberized asphalt, which helps reduce icing and skidding. Improved runway surfaces to prevent hydroplaning.
Is the rubberized asphalt more expensive than regular asphalt?
Yes.
And are we just taking, again, something that was developed somewhere else and applying it here, or did we come up with a particular mixture that fits Alaska because of temperature?
We take things that have been tried somewhere else and then adapt them to Alaska. We start with what somebody else came up with a good idea. We add in a little bit more money to try and make it work in Alaska. And that's one of those kinds of situations. This one's done in Kodiak. This is probably our most well-known project at this point, the radioluminescent airport lighting system. It's a way to provide airport lights to bush communities where there isn't electricity or where it's prohibitive to run electricity from the community 3 miles out to the airport.
Yeah. Okay. We put money in for that kind of runway lighting in Tok last year, and they, for some reason, wouldn't allow it.
FAA has not yet approved the lights for Part 135 operations. A lot of what the research is that's going on right now isn't research anymore. It's working with FAA to get those approvals so that we can start installing them. The other thing that we've got to do is work with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, because this is tritium that's regulated by the federal government, to get their approvals to use it for this application. If everything goes well, we did a beautiful test in the state of Washington last year with FAA using the RL lights. They thought, they were surprised because they were prepared to go in and shoot them down. They have not been real enthusiastic about this, and it just turned them around. And we thought we were going to get their approval, and then they said, well, we haven't looked at them under snow and ice and bad weather conditions. We need one more look. So we scheduled a test for this winter in Central again.
That's what I was going to say. Central has got them.
Well, we put them in and we took them out, the portable. We put them in for a test last winter, and we couldn't get FAA to come to that test in force. They sent a few people, but then they said, well, that wasn't adequate. So we're putting them in for them again this winter. We've got their agreement. They're going to send their tech center people up from Atlantic City. We've worked with them so that I hope this is the final test this winter, and that we'll get the FAA approval. At the same time, the North Warning System, which is the new dew line system that's going to be going in Canada and the U.S., the Air Force and the Canadians, are very, very interested in using these lights at their North Warning sites, and so they would like to participate with us in this test. The momentum is growing on this.
Is there some kind of a hazard? You got these turkeys that like to shoot out lights and stuff at the Bush airports, and I'm wondering what happens if you release tritium into the environment.
No, tritium is not a hazard. You want to do your...
they will be put in a Lexan tube, which probably can't be broken by a 22 bullet, could be broken by a very high power rifle. But to give you an example, if you were able to break one of those, and if you were then able to inhale every bit of the tritium gas, you would exhale most of it right back out. But if you were able to contain it within, you would sustain a level of radiation equal to what you get when you fly in a commercial aircraft from the west coast to the east coast to 32,000 feet.
However, let me say this. All the questions I've asked about safety, I feel, have come from Department of Energy. And I haven't felt 100% sure about that. So I've asked our research section to contact the state epidemiologist, Dr. John Madow, and ask them to look at it strictly from a health perspective. Because I want to feel 100% about that before we start going into rural communities with this new technology. And so I feel like all the evidence suggests that it's safe, but I want that same confirmation from the health perspective strictly.
Those lights are the exit lights on all the Boeing aircraft. If you look at the bulkhead where it says exit, that's a tritium light.
They also have these lights on some of the ramps, right, in Fairbanks. At the Fairbanks Airport, they have those on the on-ramp, not the on-ramps, but the taxiways.
Okay, they're experimental. Again, we did a demonstration on that. That's a really excellent use for these lights, because as airports expand, you reconfigure the taxiways. Then you have to rip up your whole lighting system, put in new wiring, put in a new system. These, you can just pick them up and move them. And we did do a demonstration project on that last year. This is probably the most exciting development that's come out of research, and we're finding there's going to be loads of applications for it. Even
in your packet, you've got that Fairbanks International Airport taxiway.
Navigation in southeast Alaska, the Canadians want to use it to mark mountaintops for airplane navigation. You'll find it being used to mark boulders in the water for tanker navigation. I think we'll find limitless uses for this new technology.
Before I forget, while Representative Schultz is here, and I want to send a message to the commissioner, Ms. Fleischauer, is that, you know, we sat through hours and hours of very boring budget hearings on the Department of Transportation. We got no information at all. I did ask some questions. I don't know whether you were there at the time or not. But I know that the Finance Committee, at least the subcommittees, would have looked a little harder at doing something for your budget if this kind of information was provided during the budget hearing process. And it's really disappointing that it wasn't, because they got a lot of good information here. Please relay that to my friends.
By the way, I did go up to Central and land, you know, with DOT, and we landed at Central with the lights. So you can see them for quite a few miles off, 5 miles maybe. The lights kind of, the RL lights light up.
And there's other advantages, that the electricity doesn't go out on them. You know, no maintenance. You don't have to wait for a maintenance man to run up and turn them on when the plane's going to land. They're there. And in Central, we had a case. I don't know if you've seen the letter someone from Central has written. It's been circulated quite widely about an evacuation. A house burned down. A man was severely burned. It was the middle of winter. They had no runway lights. But because we were there with these test lights, the medevac was able to get in and rescue this person. And the community is really...
day-to-day fashion with the basic research. We do applied research, everyday problems, simple pragmatic things. And it takes a working relationship on a day-to-day basis.
For the amount, we're talking about a $1.2 million operating budget to manage the capital budget, what I consider responsibly and productively and effectively. And I think that basically what you get out of that pays off. And that's what I want to talk about next, if you want to move on to that. Okay. What I want to do now is talk a little bit about the accomplishments of the research program. And I look at the accomplishments as six types of accomplishments here. You could divide up this pie any way you want. But actual dollar savings to the state, improved safety and preservation of human life, improved commerce, developing standards for state buildings and road construction. In other words, research does the work for standards and technical services to some great extent and works with them on developing standards. Technical assistance services within the department and to other agencies. And then we have a component which we provide a service of helping to train engineers for the future.
If I can just hold you up, the last three seem to be, I wouldn't really call them accomplishments. The setting of standards for state buildings and road construction would probably fall into one of those categories up above in the first three.
I think
guess
it
we're,
could.
We're talking about how your accomplishments are used, I guess, but
yeah.
I see three categories that are of interest to me.
Okay.
At the top.
Okay. Well, I kind of added on, especially number six, because I couldn't figure out where else to make the statement that Larry just made for us on our role with the university and how I think that's important. So, you know, maybe I shouldn't have called them accomplishments, but I did the first four, and then I thought, well,
benefits.
Maybe we should mention that these are benefits to the state. So I would agree with you about that. Let me go through each of those briefly, and I picked out examples which I thought were good examples. They're not by any means exhaustive, and they just are kind of representative. It's been said that in any given year, the research program does something which pays for the whole research program, and these are some kinds of examples. If you lift the load limits too soon, during the springtime, you can do damage at the rate of about $200,000 a day. And we've developed how to use something called the falling weight deflectometer. You're going to hear some more about that as we go along.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah, this isn't just last year. I mean, this is kind of a summary of some major accomplishments, although we're still using it and perfecting how to use it.
Last year was the first time with that instrument that we were able to determine some roads that didn't need any load restrictions at all. We put them on in the past because we had a blanket policy, but now we've become sophisticated enough with that tool to recognize that some don't need any load restrictions at all.
And I'm going to mention that again, too. Another point I want to make with the falling weight deflectometer, since we're starting there, is that this is an instrument that was developed in Scandinavia. We didn't develop it in our research lab. What we did is we brought it over here, we tested it, we figured out how to use it for our particular circumstances, we transferred that information to the department. This is a very cost-effective way to do research because what we're doing is taking what somebody else has already developed and adapting it with very little additional investment from us. We figure that we save at least $50,000 a year from design procedures that were developed, which basically reduce the need for soils testing in the design of roads. We save $100,000 a month.
I don't understand that. I don't understand what you're doing.
Okay, well, basically, we looked at how to design roads, developed new design procedures, whereby, in some cases, you don't have to take as many soil samples under certain circumstances as you would previously when you didn't know what you were doing, so you took a lot more soil samples. So by not taking those soil samples, you're saving a cost that goes into the design of a road. And we figure that total savings to the department is something in the vicinity of $50,000 a year by not unnecessarily taking soil samples.
There was a procedure that was eliminated called R-value testing. It was a standard procedure.
Incidentally, as I go through these, there's a little bit more detail on each of these in the handouts that, you know, if you go back later, what did she say about this? or give us a call and we'll get you in touch with people that actually worked on it. When a chip seal fails, it costs $100,000 a mile to go back in and replace. And we had a research project that cost us $50,000 that basically identified the major causes of chip seal failures and developed ways to prevent those failures. Now that's been happening for a couple of years. We haven't had a chance to go back and see to what extent we actually have saved money, but sometimes chip seals fail the very next year.
What's the difference between chip seal and what the Canadians do as far as the high-float emulsion?
There's basically three types of pavement. There's a hot mix, which is the most expensive. Then there's a chip seal, which is a procedure that became very popular because it was cheaper. And we started that in this state, and we ended up with a very high failure rate. And that's what initiated this research project. We went back in and found out why we had a higher failure rate than the other states. The high-float emulsion is yet a less expensive first cost or at first look procedure that we were aware of when the Canadians started because we worked with them. We've watched that, we've sampled that, we've put down three test sections of our own on the high-float emulsion, and we continue to have concern. We don't see that that is cost-effective. It's a simpler process that may not have a long-term life cycle cost benefits.
What is the difference, though? What is high-float emulsion compared to chip seal?
There's a difference in the procedure of the asphalt oil that's used, and I don't know the technical details.
Well, I was wondering, the thing here, you had that it costs $100,000 a mile. Is that what it costs? It costs more than that to chip seal.
To go back and repair a chip seal. Basically, what we found in our chip seals, when we looked at 120 sections, the failures were all when the temperature was cool or when it was damp. And Alaska tends to be cooler or damper than other states when you're putting this down. Because of our funding cycles, we end up doing it in the late summer and early fall. We have completely stopped that because we realize we're throwing money away if we do chip seals when the temperature isn't very warm and very dry.
But how much does it cost a mile to do chip seal?
I don't know. It's more than $100,000 to come back and
repair. Or they're just wondering because now the Canadians, the Yukon Territories, when they put the high-float emulsion on the Alaskan Highway, up, and this is including last year, it was costing them $20,000 a mile to put the high-float emulsion down. The highway, the Alaskan highway that you drive is made out of that. And that's at the cost of $20,000 a mile. So if it's costing us $200,000 a mile for chip seal, we should be looking at what the Canadians are doing.
We are, sir, and we've laid down three test sections in Alaska. The three regions, and we're looking at it closely, but our efforts so far don't indicate to us that that's cost-effective in the long run.
A couple of problems with chip seal that we become aware of as a result of this testing. One is that it's high-float emulsion. One is that in Canada, they do it by the highway department, and they've got the right equipment, and they've got the system down, and there's a certain sequence in which you have to do things, the system, the timing right. Here we've done it with private contractors. They don't have necessarily the right equipment and the experience, and it hasn't worked as well as it has in Canada. And second, in Canada, they found that high float is lasting about a year, maybe 2 years at the most. So it's more a dust control approach, the paving approach. It is less expensive on a first cost basis. We're not convinced yet in the long term that that's going to be the most cost effective.
But even with the cost per mile that the Canadians are spending on it, and they've, you know, in talking with them about it, they have said that yes, the road doesn't last. It's almost like grading a road or something else. But they have the system down to the point that they'll have stretches of road 30, 40 miles long that will never develop a pothole or anything else. I mean, it's just as good as the day it was put in for year after year after year. Some of that stuff has been there, you know, 7, 8 years up there on that stuff. Where they do have go through a bad permafrost areas, you know, they have it down to a science. I mean, they just send a crew out there with shovels and things and, you know, they just fill the potholes up and move on down the road.
One thing about the high-floating emulsion, Canada uses a different grade of asphalt than what we use. The asphalt they use is not available to us, evidently, through our asphalt sources. And I think that has a lot to do with it. I would like to see us find that available and get into the high float. I've studied it for several years now.
See that?
And recognize that
this is a real important research project, yeah. And
for some areas of the state, there's absolutely no reason to go in and at the $1.5 million or $1.2 million or whatever it is, dollars a mile, and put the 2 inches of asphalt and then come back in a couple of years and put 2 more inches. There's absolutely no reason. Give an example, that Northway stretch. You know, that Northway stretch will be, we've spent $20 million or $50 million or whatever it is on that stretch of road. In a short period of time, that road's going to go to pieces.
Okay? Absolutely.
Because it's permafrost, and that road just continually settles right out from underneath its, you know, its road. It doesn't have a base. What you need to do in stretches like that, you don't even need to, you can just build the road base up. Simply go on down to where you've got a salt and start paving from there. Skip that thing and put the high float emulsion down.
Yes, sir. The research section has done research on those very areas, and we have recommended more than once that that be a high speed gravel road.
Right.
Because we don't feel it's cost effective today.
Right.
And there's other areas of the state that you can have a good high speed gravel road. There's a public education problem there too, because the public perceives that you're going backwards if you had pavement and now you have something else. But I couldn't agree with you more, and we've done a lot of work on that and economics on that.
Yeah.
And
because we're just throwing money into those projects, and like you said, we put millions and millions of dollars into that project, and it's not going to last.
This is another example like that, where Anchorage was set to pave a runway that would cost $3 million. We took that falling weight deflectometer there and in one day determined the paving wasn't going to solve the cracking problem. And so we saved the state basically $3 million from not paving it and then having to turn around next year and tear the whole thing up and do the right thing. Just some other examples. We developed solar-powered flasher signals for highway and rail crossings that are expected to save the state $406,000 over the next 21 years. I feel like that's a long span of time, unless that is a long-term cost saving.
I understand that you're requiring one to be put in down around the Nenana area, and I'm just wondering where you have pretty consistent temperatures of 50 and 60 below zero. And these solar-powered flashers on the railroad crossings and things. Have you put them out in a remote area like that?
Yes, sir. There's the first one, I think, was on down past Nenana, and the battery box is buried in the ground, and the snow cover keeps it plenty warm. We haven't had any trouble. It's worked very, very well. We're very happy with it, and even in the dead of winter, there's enough solar energy to keep it going. The trains run less frequently in the dead of winter too, so it has less draw. That's an example of a simple. There's no electricity out there.
That's
there's
right.
No power out there.
So, that would be a considerable cost.
Yeah, so it's much more than $406,000. I mean, you consider that you have to send one of your electric technicians out there to fix it every 6 months or something.
I think all these figures are very conservative. We didn't try and overstate the case here. In fact, we looked at these figures yesterday and even pared some of them back a little bit more. So I think you're seeing some kind of, these things aren't things you go out and weigh and measure exactly. They're estimates, basically. So, and they're conservative estimates. A single lawsuit against the state saved the state $3 million, and the main defense was research. Basically, it had to do with research on sanding that showed that the state was not being negligent because we were trying to solve this problem. The Attorney General's office increasingly now is looking to research as a defense, and we're being called upon to testify, basically to show that the state is not ignoring these certain types of safety problems, that we're working towards certain goals, and that seems to be an effective defense. So that's just another cost a way to look at research in the state. Another suit, another way that research has saved in lawsuits, another suit, it was $200,000. The information in a report that had been put together by the research program was used as part of the defense, and that lawsuit was also won. This also is a very conservative figure. We figure that you save at least $300,000 per river crossing if you can use culverts instead of bridges. However, in order to use the culverts instead of bridges, we've got to get Fish and Game and DEC and other people to sign off on that approach. And they're not convinced that, that's the best thing for fish.
How
that
big
are
culverts do they make?
They make big
the
ones.
Train down a sewer, for example? I mean, that's close to basically a culvert. The last few years, where they've had the avalanche problems, what they've done is put in this, it's a giant culvert, the trains to go through, so if the avalanche comes, just go right over.
We're looking at different ways to put in culverts. We're looking at a lot of hydrology, fish passage research, trying to get the data together to convince the other departments of state government that, this is a good way to proceed.
I would appreciate it if you take a look at, two bridges on a road.
I bet it's in Northway.
That's right. In Northway. And the feasibility of putting culverts in there instead of bridges, because there's two bridges. There are two one-lane bridges going into Northway over Fish Creek. Anyway,
good point.
The present cost of that thing, and we can't come up with the dollars, is about over $2 million.
That's a good example
of
where...
Can you compare that then to our annual operating budget to see if we can develop the criteria, and we have from our work on fish passage through drainage structures to date, we have developed enough information that we have some interim procedures that are being used by the department that are acceptable to Fish and Game for the design of culverts. They have already more than paid for all our research to date on them.
But I will look specifically into that and get back with you on information.
Appreciate
I'm familiar
it.
With that problem. Okay, I didn't list out all the other examples, but I just wanted to mention to you, for example, we're building a runway in Shishmaref. Standard design would have us barging in gravel for the runway because there's no gravel there. It's just a little sandy island, for those of you who've been to Shishmaref. The research section identified the possibility of using something called a sand confinement grid, which has been developed elsewhere, a plastic grid system. We went and looked at those and tested them and evaluated them, and now that airport's being built using the sand confinement grid, which is looks like a very structurally sound way to go, which is going to be considerably less costly than had we had to barge in gravel there. Another example is we've been working on roadway insulation, which can save several inches of gravel in roadway design. And so that's another cost-effective project.
I have one thing that I've had a lot of old-timers tell me on the building of roads, and they've been involved in construction for many, many years up here through permafrost areas. And you always have the buckling and the heaving and things in the permafrost areas. I've had some people tell me that if you would come into an area, and let's just say it's 100 yards long, if you would come into this area, strip it down to the permafrost, and it just turns to muck, of course, take piling, drive the piling, just drive it down until you hit a solid base, okay? Drive it right on through until you hit, you know, drill it, whatever you have to do to find out there's bedrock down there. Drive piling down. Then come in and put a layer of cement and that kind of stuff, and blocks over there to cap this stuff off. Then the mesh stuff that you're putting down on the roads now, that...
Geotextiles.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Put those mats over the top of that, then come in with your bull rock and whatever over the top of that. That would build a base, and that it would never settle.
I think that could be done, and that's
very
essentially
expensive.
Building a bridge. It's essentially building a bridge. There may be a cheaper way, and we've put in two installations you've got in your packet there. This is using these thermopiles like they used on the pipeline in Fairbanks, we have an installation, and the Bethel bump, the infamous Bethel bump on the Bethel Airport was solved that way. So that keeps the ground frozen and stabilized, and that looks like it may be cheaper.
There's an infamous North Plate bump too on the road going into North. Honest to God, there is. It's over the period of years, I think they've drilled that now, and it's 70 some foot or 80 some foot of gravel that they have put into this one place. Just as soon as you cross the one lane bridge, there's a little thing you hit. They'll fill it up, level it off, and it'll be great. You'll drive over it, and then, you know, about the spring of the year, there'll be a little dip there, and then it'll get worse. And then, you know, pretty soon you're airborne, and then they'll come in.
Those are the kinds of problems that research is looking for, more cost-effective solutions than just dumping gravel and pavement into a big sinkhole.
Did you ever fix that sinkhole by the interstate university?
That's the one that that is in your packet there that I just showed up.
Okay, I know that your time is short. I don't want to rush you, so interrupt me if I'm going too fast through here, but I do know that you do. In addition to cost savings, I mentioned improved safety and preservation of human life. Some examples are developing a halon gas system for bushfire protection. This would be used instead of a sprinkler system. It's cost effective as well as safety improvement. Developing rubberized asphalt, which helps reduce icing and skidding. Improved runway surfaces to prevent hydroplaning.
Is the rubberized asphalt more expensive than regular asphalt?
Yes.
And are we just taking, again, something that was developed somewhere else and applying it here, or did we come up with a particular mixture that fits Alaska because of temperature?
We take things that have been tried somewhere else and then adapt them to Alaska. We start with what somebody else came up with as a good idea. We add in a little bit more money to try and make it work in Alaska. And that's one of those kinds of situations. This one's done in Kodiak. This is probably our most well-known project at this point, the radioluminescent airport lighting system. It's a way to provide airport lights to bush communities where there isn't electricity or where it's prohibitive to run electricity from the community 3 miles out to the airport.
Yeah. Okay. We put money in for that kind of runway lighting in Tok last year, and they, for some reason, wouldn't allow it.
FAA has not yet approved the lights for Part 135 operations. A lot of what the research is that's going on right now isn't research anymore. It's working with FAA to get those approvals so that we can start installing them. The other thing that we've got to do is work with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, because this is tritium that's regulated by the federal government, to get their approvals to use it for this application. If everything goes well, we did a beautiful test in the state of Washington last year with FAA using the RL lights. They thought, they were surprised, because they were prepared to go in and shoot them down. They have not been real enthusiastic about this, and it just turned them around. And we thought we were going to get their approval, and then they said, well, we haven't looked at them under snow and ice and bad weather conditions. We need one more look. So we scheduled a test for this winter in Central again.
I was going to say, Central has got them.
Well, we put them in and we took them out, the portable. We put them in for a test last winter, and we couldn't get FAA to come to that test in force. They sent a few people, but then they said, well, that wasn't adequate. So we're putting them in for them again this winter. We've got their agreement. They're going to send their tech center people up from Atlantic City. We've worked with them so that I hope this is the final test this winter, and that we'll get the FAA approval. At the same time, the North Warning System, which is the new dew line system that's going to be going in Canada and the U.S., the Air Force, the Canadians, are very, very interested in using these lights at their North Warning sites, and so they would like to participate with us in this test. The momentum is growing on this.
Is there some kind of a hazard? You got these turkeys that like to shoot out lights and stuff at the bush airports, and I'm wondering what happens if...
They will be put in a Lexan tube, which probably can't be broken by a 22 bullet, could be broken by a very high power rifle. But to give you an example, if you were able to break one of those, and if you were then able to inhale every bit of the tritium gas, you would exhale most of it right back out. But if you were able to contain it within you would sustain a level of radiation equal to what you get when you fly in a commercial aircraft from the west coast to the east coast at 32,000 feet.
However, let me say this. All the questions I've asked about safety, I feel have come from Department of Energy. And I haven't felt 100% sure about that. So I've asked our research section to contact the state epidemiologist, Dr. John Madow, and ask them to look at it strictly from a health perspective, because I want to feel 100% about that before we start going into rural communities with this new technology. And so I feel like all the evidence suggests that it's safe, but I want that same confirmation from the health perspective strictly.
Those lights are the exit lights on all the Boeing aircraft. If you look at the bulkhead where it says exit, that's a tritium light.
They also have these lights on some of the ramps, right, in Fairbanks. At the Fairbanks Airport, they have those on the on-ramp, not the on-ramps, but the taxiways.
Okay, they're experimental. Again, we did a demonstration on that. That's a really excellent use for these lights, because as airports expand, you reconfigure the taxiways. Then you have to rip up your whole lighting system, put in new wiring, put in a new system. These, you can just pick them up and move them. And we did do a demonstration project on that last year. This is probably the most exciting development that's come out of research and with mining. There's going to be loads of applications for it.
In your packet, you've got that Fairbanks International Airport taxiway.
Navigation in southeast Alaska, the Canadians want to use it to mark mountaintops for airplane navigation. You'll find it being used to mark boulders in the water for tanker navigation. I think we'll find limitless uses for this new technology.
Before I forget, while Representative Schultz is here, and I want to send a message to the commissioner, Ms. Fleshauer, and he says, you know, we sat through hours and hours of very boring budget hearings on the Department of Transportation. We got no information at all. I did ask some questions. I don't know whether you were there at the time or not. But I know that the Finance Committee, at least the subcommittees, would have looked a little harder at doing something for your budget if this kind of information was provided during the budget hearing process. And it's really disappointing that it wasn't, because they got a lot of good information here. Please relay that to my friends.
By the way, I did go up to Central and land, you know, with DOT, and we landed at Central with the lights. So you can see them for quite a few miles off, 5 miles maybe. The lights kind of, the RL lights light up.
And there's other advantages, that the electricity doesn't go out on them. You know, no maintenance. You don't have to wait for a maintenance man to run up and turn them on when the plane's going to land. They're there. And in Central, we had a case. I don't know if you've seen the letter someone from Central has written. It's been circulated quite widely about an evacuation. A house burned down. A man was severely burned. It was the middle of winter. They had no runway lights. But because we were there with these test lights, the medevac was able to get in and rescue this person. And the community is really sold on
that.
That
was 1 week after the lights were installed.
Yeah.
Isn't that something? I think they have the lights in the bush where you fly over with a plane and you do something with the radio and mm-hmm. clicks them on. And we flew over Circle Hot Springs, I think, that same day and tried to click the lights on and go on.
That's a problem. We've installed a lot of lights around the state that aren't working. And that's an advantage of these. And they're cheaper. We figure by the time you put the electricity out to the runway and buy the lights and put in conventional lights, you're talking about, at least $500,000 to light a runway. With these lights, the cost of tritium is going down due to some reactors in Canada. And we figure that a set of these lights would probably, in the future, cost in the vicinity of about $20,000. And they're nothing to install. You pick them up, you fly them out there, you put them on the runway, and you leave. And then when you don't need them anymore, you can move them somewhere else. And they're good for ice runways, you know, in the wintertime, for HERCs to be able to land. North Slope Borough is very excited about that possibility. When you're doing heavy construction work and you can light the runway, when your project's over, you pick them up and, you know, you can put them on rivers, you can put them anywhere, you know, in the wintertime, and pick them up and go use them somewhere else. They're real exciting. Well, again, let me zip through this because I could talk on all day, and I know nobody has all day to go. A lot of the research is going to help improve commerce. We helped to adapt the land sea aviation and navigation system. It was a marine navigation system before that. for, I need to tell the San Cato about Lorraine C, I'm sure, and it's Houston Studies. The automated recorded, weather recording system we're working on. We help to improve traffic signals in Anchorage and Fairbanks.
Could you explain that one for Anchorage?
Computerizing. It's better than it was, I realize. But basically, we worked out a computer system for traffic signals to help traffic move better. I realize there are other constraining factors, and I won't pretend to say it solved all the problems of Anchorage, but merely that we did improve the signal system there. The jet foil demonstration project, we did the evaluation for that in Southeast.
What was the evaluation? What did you come up with? I'm curious.
The question was, how would it compare with air transportation and that sort of thing. It was very high user acceptance. It was very, very dependable. And the bottom line was that it was well-liked.
But cost-wise?
I think you have to look at two different things there. It's a costing machine. I took a ride on it, and I thought that it would be worthwhile for the state to buy one just for search and rescue and taking care of its waters. Boy, that thing really went fine and fast on rough water.
You know, that's what I've often thought about that thing, too, and I agree with you, you know, search, rescue, that type of thing. But it's always, it'll be sitting a lot of times, and I would think that there would be, it could be used to shuttle freight very quickly and very efficiently back and forth to some of these smaller trips.
I was very impressed with it.
This last item here is the flip side Larry mentioned before about the falling weight deflectometer and load restrictions. Because we can now measure that, we can take off the load restrictions when they're not needed, and this makes the truckers very happy because we've entirely eliminated load restrictions on some highways, and we've shortened the amount of time on some highways because we have a much higher degree of certainty than we had before. Okay, I'm just going to throw this up here. I won't go into any great detail because of time, but the research section has developed standards for the department. In a number of areas, including thermal and lighting performance standards, which were mandated by the legislature. You might wonder about solar and wind energy manuals. Why are we doing that? A couple of years ago, it started that our clients, which are other state agencies, started coming to us, asking us to design buildings with those features in it, and the private sector designers started coming to us with designs with those features in it, and the department really had no way to evaluate those designs and whether they were going to be cost-effective and workable and so forth and how to deal with them. So they asked research basically to give some guidance on that, and that's what we did. I'm just going to mention here briefly technical assistance services to other within DOT and PF and other agencies. When we get a complex job, we have very skilled technical people in our research section, and they are sometimes asked to help designers on certain kinds of jobs. And we're also asked by other agencies to help out. We have some specialized equipment that's nowhere else in the state, and for example, Fairbanks Memorial Hospital was worried that there was some contamination in the air that was spreading amongst the rooms. We were able to go in and determine that, in fact, that was the case and where it was coming from and what the airflow was and be able to help them solve their problem. In the last 8 months, we've had 274 requests for technical information from outside the department. Not to mention the requests from within the department. With regard to seminars, in the back of this annual report that you have in your possession, under implementation, page 31, we list the seminars that we put on the previous year and those kinds of activities. Technical reports are listed on page 40 of this annual report the past year. You'll notice on page 39 that the number of technical reports has increased rather steadily. We're producing with our money, we're getting conclusions, we're publishing those, we're sharing those. With regard to newsletters, you have the packet of newsletters. These come out once a month. We have about 600 people on our mailing list. They're one page, easy to read. If people want more information, they can find out more about what we're doing. We're involved in joint efforts with a number of other agencies. So we provide a support service that goes beyond the department. And finally, I just wanted to mention that our close relationship with the University of Alaska, we share facilities there. We have a joint use agreement for laboratories and equipment, so students and faculty can use the our equipment and we can use theirs. We provide research opportunities for both students and faculty. Larry mentioned that 85% of the research budget for the Institute of Water Resources and the Experimental Research Station comes through DOT and PF. And at least one professor up there mentioned the other day to one of our staff that every single one of his graduate students had worked on DOT and PF projects. We also offer summer employment opportunities and research opportunities for students. The engineering training program is something that goes on throughout the department, but many of those engineers in training do rotation through the research section. And finally, we do provide lectures and seminars for professional audiences, and that's also listed in this book. I appreciate this opportunity to present this information. If you have any questions, I'm certainly happy to try to answer them.
One final comment for me, and that is, I think you should get wider distribution of these things. You probably ought to send them to the legislators on a regular basis.
Okay.
And my main concern when I asked the chairman, whom I appreciate convening this meeting, my main concern is not the quality of the work or what you're doing, but it's the project selection process. I've talked to the commissioner about it. I know he's aware. I would like to see some legislative input into the project selection, the advisory and board and the prioritization.
How would you do that? Do you have a specific idea about that?
Well, I'm sure there are several ways. One way might be to ask the speaker and the president of the Senate to appoint one person, one member from each body to participate.
Is there any problem with separation of powers or anything to do that?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. I think that's a great idea because, for one thing, when we come back to the legislature with our program, there'll be at least two people that will understand what we're proposing to do, and I would certainly support that idea.
I certainly would do it because it's been communications. What we're doing is what our problem is.
Yeah. You should try to make sure that the members that are selected are on the Finance Committee.
Good strategy.
Ma'am, do you have a copy of your report?
I have the graphics that I've been using, I have copies of those. I don't have anything written up beyond that. I was basically speaking to those, and I'm happy to.
All right, we'd like to have that to give some of the other members.
Sure. I'm happy to do that. And then all the handouts that we've given out, I have copies of those.
Ma'am, we've been running past noon, and so I'm not sure how much time we're going to have or exactly, but I referred to that question earlier. But I if we do have the time, I mean, if we get out early, then you should at least have 15 minutes, I would think, that you could talk to us.
I'd be happy to do that. When and where do you meet?
And the Butchovich room. Unfortunately, I have to run off right now, too.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you coming and staying and listening. And any suggestions you have, we're certainly welcome.
I just wrote a note to Pinalberry to write to the finance persons on the Senate side to support an increased budget. But I think you can maybe help that cause while you're down here. I know that's not the whole. It's not the whole solution, but it's a step forward.
Well, I'm happy to talk to anybody who would like some information about what we're doing.
Ma'am, we appreciate very much you coming down, and I'm sure that Mike's idea of having lunch and that sort of thing was great. I'm sure that Marco would be getting in touch. And if you don't mind, you're through with your business.
I'm finished, thank you.
Don't mind that I'll adjourn the meeting.